stories are there to help us. They help us make sense of the world. And there's something very attractive, isn't there, about a person telling a story where they've overcome a struggle. I mean, the Second World War, you know, in Britain's psyche, is just massive about how they see the world 80 years on. We hit that nostalgia button or hit a view of the world that's very rosy, that's completely not necessarily even true, you know, but we create a myth and we all respond to it.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Mark Hogan, a renowned speaker and psychologist with a pretty interesting path from selling missiles, drugs, and cigarettes to stand-up comedy and coaching leaders. LinkedIn is a funny place and can be noisy and isolating like all social media is, but can also create real connections. And that's how I came across Mark. There was something about what he was saying and how he was saying it that hit me right between the eyes. Brutally honest, a bit out there, and funny as shit. Mark talks about getting pulled over by the cops with a truckload of missiles and realizing, yeah, maybe he needed a change. He's most famous for taking a $1 bet to do a stand-up routine at the largest comedy festival in the world. A move that led him to psychology and traveling the world speaking to Fortune 500 companies about his unique insights on leadership. This was so much fun and left me with a lot to think about around how I spend the remaining years of my career and how I show up with those around me. Please enjoy Mark Hogan. All right, welcome Mark Hogan to the podcast. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Hiya, Bob. Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. The sun is shining outside, so all is well with the world.
Well, yeah, speaking of the world, so you do a lot of traveling on your speaking. What part of the world are you in now?
So I'm in London right now, just outside London. I do an awful lot of speaking in Europe. I'm off to Ireland next week, actually, which will be nice. That'd be really nice. It's always nice to do a gig in Ireland because I'm Irish originally. I've done some events in America, but mostly it's Europe.
Well, yeah, you do a lot of, I mean, the things that you speak about, I'm excited to dig into that, but you've also got a really interesting kind of origin story. You talk about having worked for in the defense industry, for big tobacco, for pharmaceutical, and, you know, and this idea of selling weapons, cigarettes, and drugs for 10 plus years, and then deciding maybe that wasn't how you wanted to spend the rest of your career. I'd love to hear a little bit about, I guess, two things. One, what was it about working for those industries that kind of grounded you or made you realize that you didn't want to do that? And how do you make that transition?
You know, obviously selling weapons, cigarettes, and drugs doesn't fill the heart with ethical salesmanship there. I'd like to point out that I fell into these. These were not.
We're a young boy, like, I'm going to sell drugs and cigarettes and guns.
Yeah. As a child, I want to sell weapons of mass destruction. That's what I want to do, you know, on my school day. And people are bringing in, well, I want to be a geography teacher. I'm bringing in models of missiles or something. I have a very working class background. My father is a carpenter. I didn't know many people who were business people, you know, who worked in banks or big organizations. But I had a friend, called Mark Wright, whose family kind of looked after me a lot in my teenage years. And his dad worked for a company called GEC Marconi, which was a huge, great big conglomerate that did aeronautical stuff, did weapons, had defense contracts, but also had civil aviation contracts, et cetera, et cetera. So when I had to do a dissertation for my degree about business, you know, I went and spoke to Mark's dad because that was the only person I kind of knew who had any, you know, big business experience. So I wrote my dissertation, didn't do very well as a degree, but GEC Marconi at the time were looking for some graduate recruitment. And, you know, I went for an interview and they said, well, what do you know about the company? And I just, you know, in a flourish, pulled out of my bag my 70-page dissertation on GEC Marconi. And I went, well, you know, just that. And God bless them. And the idiots gave me a job. And that was it. And I did that for 3-4 years. And it was just a very odd thing to be talking about weapons and missiles. I mean, I can tell you a funny story. So this is pre-mobile phones. So I'm 22, 23, trying to be keen and exciting. And we had a missile system called Brimstone, which I think probably still in use today. And it went on planes. But obviously, this is pre-mobile phones, pre-even real internet and modeling and graphic design. So what they used to do was they would create missile models. So basically, you know, the shell and the casing with no explosives in that you could attach to the planes and people could take photographs of them. You know, you could see what this thing was. So someone wanted to buy some of these missiles, some country, I'm not sure who. And they were coming on a Saturday to an RAF site up north somewhere, a few hundred miles away. And no one in the job wanted to drive up with these model missiles, but I was keen. And I said, oh, I'll do it. So 1 o'clock, we load up all these missiles, and they're in these big wooden crates with straw in. And I depart at 2-3 o'clock in the evening. So winter, so it's going to be dark by. So I'm driving up, it's about 8 or 9 o'clock. RAF sites are normally in the middle of nowhere. They're not very well signposted. And I'm lost, completely lost. And I'm driving along down this dark lane, and next minute I look in the mirror, and, you know, the blue lights start flashing. And I think it's the police. Great. Well, that'll be all right. That'll be okay. And then, of course, I realise I'm Irish. And he kind of gets out of the car. He knocks on the window. He says, what are you doing? And I'm like, hello there. Do you know the way to the RAF base, whatever it is? And he's immediately, you know, this is just post the RA bombings. And he can see he's a little, you know, a little nervous. Oh, okay. He said, you know, what are you going there? Oh, I'm going there to deliver something. What are you going there to deliver? And at that moment, my brain starts saying, oh, this is not going to go well. I went, models? Models of what? Missiles? And he goes, like, could you get out of the car, please? So straight out of the car. And he's like, you know, he's got his truncheon out. He's like, could you open the back, sir? I'm like, open the back. And there's all these wooden boxes, you know, with defense things on them. And, you know, he's like, would you mind opening one of these for me? So, of course, I have to get the crowbar out. Like, flick it open, and this missile, and you can see this policeman thinks, this is it, I've hit the mother load. You know, I'm arresting you. And this, you know, before I knew it, I was handcuffed, and it took an awful lot of explaining. It was all fine in the end, but it took an awful lot of explaining and a lot of phone calls at 11 o'clock at night to various people to prove who I was and that I was not some terrorist with a missile heading towards an RAF base. Once that happened, I thought, I'm in the wrong game. I want to get out of that business. So that was why, in a roundabout way, is why I left the defense industry. And then, yeah, I got a job working in marketing. And you ever had any dealings with a tobacco company?
I know of them from movies and lore, right? Because as I was coming up, it was really about it was all these investigations about what they knew about the effects of tobacco, et cetera, and the class action suits, but yeah, not really.
So I assumed, so that's all I knew. So I thought these are going to be evil people kind of thing. And all these people were the loveliest people you had ever met. I'd never met an organization where everyone was so together and joined to, you know, and I think because they know that everyone thinks they're going to be horrible, they've got a really good culture of oneness, you know? And I think it helped that everyone got 200 cigarettes a month. So I think people were happy about that. So I did that for 5 or 6 months. And then I did some other marketing stuff. And I got a job working in the pharmaceutical industry. Actually, ironically enough, selling drugs to deal with COPD or what we used to call emphysema, basically smoking-related lung diseases. So that felt slightly better for the soul doing that. Even though drugs companies are also interesting places to work in. And might have a slight grayish area sometimes in terms of how they sell things and what they sell and how they look at diseases. So so that was a really interesting time as well.
And that's a very similar kind of path, is that, and it's just like me too. Like, I got a job out of school and then it wasn't what I always wanted to do, but I got that job and then I got promoted and I got a raise and then somebody came and offered me a different job, and you just kind of put one foot in front of the other. So that's pretty common. But as you're doing that, what was it that made you realize that you needed to do something different?
So I've always been interested in psychology. Have you guys ever heard of Paul McKenna?
I don't think so.
Kind of celebrity hypnotist in the UK. I went to see his show, his hypnotism show, and I remember being kind of blown away by this. So that tweaked my interest. And then I went and bought a lot of books on hypnotism, on self-hypnotism, and then recorded my voice and try and hypnotize myself and realized I could do that. And then I thought, well, if I can do that to me, can I do it to other people? And then I had friends who were silly enough to allow me to try and practice on hypnotizing them. So, you know, by the time I was 19, 20, I knew how to hypnotize people. I could do it. It was like a party trick. But that was quite good fun and interesting. I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then I started thinking, well, could I get into hypnotherapy and various other things? And that led to a thing called NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. So all the time, all this psychology stuff is kind of in the background. So, and I'm kind of applying that a little bit to my jobs in sales and marketing, because they're all about communication. They're all about storytelling. They're all about how people are influenced by words and things. So I'm kind of, it all kind of begins to fit into that stuff. Till eventually I'm giving a speech about taking risks and doing things differently at an event. And a guy called Jim Lawless, who is a famous speaker here in the UK, written a couple of books. And he said, what risks have you ever taken? Just got married, got 110% mortgage. You know, hadn't really taken any risks. And he sort of said to me, well, if you don't mind me saying, you're quite funny. Which is a lot like a lover saying you're quite good in bed. And I thought I was a bit offended. I thought, thanks. I think he said, but it's easy to make a corporate audience laugh, let's face it, because they're not expecting very much. And he said, what about a comedy audience? Now, I had never been to a comedy club, but I knew like they did open mic nights and things like that. I said, what? Do you want me to do like 5 minutes, like an open mic night somewhere? And he said, No. He said, you speak for a living, you know, you can do something much bigger than that or at least much further north. What do you mean? He said, the Edinburgh Comedy Festival. Now, the Edinburgh Comedy Festival is the world's biggest comedy festival. It's probably the very first one. And thousands of people go up. It's huge, great big arts and comedy. And I kind of looked at him and went, well, I've never been to Edinburgh. You know, and he goes, well, I said, it's on now. It's on like a week's time. I said, do you want me to go up and do like 5 minutes there? He said, no. I want you to do a full 1 hour, one man show for the full 21 nights of the festival. And if I'm honest, I'm thinking, who's the bloody comedian here? And he said, but I don't expect you to do it now. I'll give you a year and I'll make it worth your while. And this was back in 2008. He said, I'll bet you. And I said, how much will you bet me? And he went, a pound. And back in 2008, a pound was worth a lot of money. So I took the bet. And 1 year later, I found myself at the Edinburgh Comedy Festival doing a show. And that was it. That was where my speaking career sort of just took off. That was that. And suddenly I found myself, you know, this in this strange job, going out and speaking to people about taking personal responsibility and risks and communication. And suddenly, I've dined out on that for the last 15 years.
Yeah, that is, there's a couple of things that strike me about that story. One, I think if you talk to a lot of people, One of their fears is public speaking, like even getting up at a wedding or making a toast. That's something that is just pretty common. But even among the people that have gotten over that, or maybe never had a fear of that, people are okay with public speaking. The idea of doing a comedy set, I think to me is like the most terrifying things. And then doing it at the largest comedy festival. And you talked about maybe corporate audiences, it's easy to make them laugh. That's got to be a tough audience. They're there because they're expecting a pretty high bar of comedians. So what did you learn from that? I don't know how I overcome all the hurdles that you must have had to overcome to get there.
I think the first thing was, is, look, clearly I'm an idiot. I was naive. I thought, how hard can that be? So I think, you know, there's a really interesting thing. So obviously, there's the big five personality traits that people have, you know, openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And, you know, I only know this now, but I score off the charts on extroversion. So, you know, you put me in a room with 100 people, I'm in the top 8 people, maybe top 4. You know, I'm off the charts. That is a blessing and a curse, depending on how you see the world. You know, when I get that from my mom, is naturally, you know, I come from a long line of practical jokers and storytellers. There was always silly jokes going on. And, you know, I knew how to crack a joke. I could hold my own on a thing. So I thought, well, how hard can this be? And I've got a year. And I did find a producer of the show, and I found a person to help me write the show. And then I realized, oh, crikey, this is really hard, much, much harder than I ever thought it would be. But of course, I've committed to it now, and I've told people I'm doing it. This bus is moving, and I can't jump off. You know, we're at speed. It's at 50 miles per hour. I can't get off the bus. So it was a mixture of naivety, you know, high extroversion. I am open to new ideas. You know, I score highly in openness as well. So, you know, it's a combination of my personality traits, which are genetic, and my life experiences that had kind of just on that day had happened before I knew it. I'm a year later, I'm on stage in this tiny little kind of bar, 7:15 in the evening. I'm just looking over at the poster there. I've still got it on the wall. You know, with an average of about 30 people, this tiny room where I would try and convince 30 people to pay £10, and then I would try and make them laugh for 55 minutes.
Yeah, man. Yes, overcoming that fear of judgment, I think, that holds so many of us back, and then breaking it into pieces and getting help. God, I love that. Terrifying. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about quickly is, so a couple of really interesting things. You and I came across each other on LinkedIn, because I've got a love-hate relationship with LinkedIn, but this is an example of a LinkedIn creating a real genuine connection. We're having an awesome conversation here, and that wouldn't have happened without LinkedIn. So I'm really grateful for that. And so there's been a few things about your content that resonated with me. And one of these things that there's a kind of common theme is this idea that why can't we all kind of get along? But you really approach it from a kind of behavioral science or, you know, a psychology background, which I find really interesting and refreshing. So I was hoping you could tell me a bit about that.
It's the most common, or one of the most researched and well-respected views of personality, the big five. Depending on which scientist you read, which psychologist you read, you know, that can be up to 60% can be genetic. And the reason they know this is from twin studies, where, you know, in America in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, twins were separated and adopted, identical twins, this is, you know, completely unethically, you know, you won't be able to do this now. Follow these twins and see what happened to them over the years. And what you would find is that because they are genetically identical, technically they should have the same personality traits because they're stable over time and they're trait-based. So what they would find is, let's say, and look, I'm paraphrasing here, and I can't, you know, I haven't got the exact papers in front of me, but let's say someone was high in neuroticism, which, you know, in layman's terms is anxiety and depression. And the person, the twin that ended up in a very stable home, you know, maybe more affluent, well looked after, might have a mild anxiety disorder of some sort if she scored high or if they scored high in, you know, neuroticism. But the other identical twin, who maybe went to a home that was, you know, more chaotic, maybe there was a family breakdown, you know, money worries, whatever it might be, their neuroticism trait could end up being quite severe. They could end up with severe anxiety or severe depression or whatever. So it's the classic nature nurture debate. That 60% of your personality is nature, genetics. And this other 40% is nurture. It's your life experiences. It's your first team. It's your family. It's how you grew up. It's all those things. And some people would go, oh, God, that's a fait accompli. I can't outrun my genetics. And that may be true. You know, I'm never going to be, I mean, I'm 6 foot and 12 stone, wet. You know, I'm never going to be an 18 stone, you know, hunk of a man. I can't, my genetics are not going to allow me to become that. But in terms of psychological terms, you know, this is 40% that we've got to play with, which I'm really hopeful about, that we can learn from our experiences. We can learn good lessons, we can learn bad lessons. But as we get older, we can learn to go, okay, not only are we different because of our genetics, but we're also different because of our experiences. And maybe if we understand that about each other, maybe it'll help us explain why we do what we do. And why everyone else in the company or why all our friends aren't idiots. You know, it's you know, they're not awkward so-and-so. It's just they've got a different set of personality traits to me and a different set of experiences. And I think that's really powerful to just even begin to see the world in that way. And then we might start to understand each other just a little bit better. And if we understand each other a little bit better, maybe we can find some common ground. We might never be best friends. That's cool. But we might be able to find some common ground.
Yeah. One of the things that I remember from my, you know, study of psychology, and I took quite a bit of it in school, and some of it really stuck in a way that other courses I took didn't, is this fundamental attribution error where the things that we do that are successful, we attribute to things that we've done, hard work we've done, and we discount our environment or luck, right? Whereas I see you running a red light, I'm like, oh, what an asshole. How could he put at risk the lives of him and his family and everybody around him? Whereas when I run a red light, oh, my kid's got to get to hockey practice. I've always got a reason for explaining it. So when you describe that, it's an interesting way of reminding ourselves that everybody's got kind of a story. And I honestly, for the vast majority of my career up until fairly recently, I really wouldn't have given much of that thought. I judged people based on the behaviors that I saw, and I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about why they did what they did or even why I did what I did.
Yeah, I think I was probably very much the same. You know, I could be very judgy. I probably still can be very judgy at times. But I think when I trained to become a coaching psychologist, the whole idea of speaking to someone is to take all judgment out of it, to take everything out of it, you know, to meet the person as they are and not have a vested interest. This sounds weird, and not care what they say, but still care about the person. If you understand what I'm saying, you know, you're not trying to change them or influence them or whatever you're trying to do, you're just there listening completely non-judgmentally about their life and their experiences and how they see the world.
So if somebody's listening to this, what are the one or two things that they can do to start, you know, meeting people where they are or leaving some of that judgment aside? What are some of the exercises that you coach people on?
So it's a really good question, and there aren't really exercises as much. It's more insight. I'm an Irishman in England, so you know I'm the outsider already in some respects. So I kind of view the world from a slightly outsider perspective. And I think when I meet people, and certainly as a coach when I'm working with individuals and teams and I'm observing a behavior or someone's talking about certain things, you know, my question always will be, how do you think that's serving you? How does that affect your work? You know, invariably, if you ask someone about their first team, and their first team is their family, you'll find a huge amount of how people behave in their teams at work has a lot to do with how they behaved in their first team. You know, and if your first team was competitive or argumentative, or the dinner table was a place of rigorous debate or arguments or very parental control saying, you must do as I say, do as I do, not as I say. Often what you'll find is that that is transposed to adulthood, where a person will be very, possibly very subordinate to positions of authority. For, you know, do as I say, not as I do. You know, okay, I'll, this boss is the person, therefore I must do everything they do. They tell me to do, which can lead to, you know, overwork, burnout, all that other stuff. To maybe it was a much more argumentative dynamic. I mean, I come from a very, you know, Irish argumentative household, and I would argue with authority all the time. The moment a boss would say, you've got to do this or do that, I'd be like, why? Just tell me why. And invariably, most of the time, they could never tell me why, except someone above wants it, which always sounded the most terrible excuse to me in the world. So I would argue back. So when I see people in a coaching context, you know, my question would always be, so what's, you know, tell me a little bit about your childhood and figure out what's driving that. And more importantly, all of those things, whether you're deferential to a person, whether you're argumentative, there's good and bad to those things, isn't there? There's good things that, you know, we always say that employees want really conscientious people, you know, because they'll work harder, you know, because they're going to get the job done. But so that's a good thing. But the downside of that is they may work too hard. They may get burnout. They may, you know, they may never challenge authority. They may never do all those things that are kind of useful in an organization. Whilst an argumentative person might be useful in terms of, well, why are we doing this? Why is there a better way? Can we make this better? But at the same time, they're a pain in the neck to manage. But if we know that everyone has different experiences, different pasts, that might explain why they are behaving the way they are at work. Is there a pattern to their behavior? Are we repeating a pattern? And then what's also interesting is does that pattern help serve you, or does it, when does it not serve you? And also, what happens if there's a change? You know, as a coach, I will be sometimes asked to coach people whose performance has dipped, or a person wants to improve their performance. My question generally is, if a person has generally been behaving at a certain level and then suddenly changes for whatever reason, something else is going on. And it may be at home, it may be at work, but something's happened that's affected that performance. It's not blaming the individual saying, you're not doing the thing that I want you. Something else is going on. And we don't know if there's money problems, you know, family issues, just maybe they've changed the office, it's further away and they have to drive for, you know, anything. It could be 101 things that could affect an individual's performance that we're very happy to label them as the person that's the problem. But it actually might not be them. There might be other things going on. And if we, you know, if we're kind, you know, just go, okay, and try and find out a little bit more, then maybe we'll find out what that reason is. And it's not because they're bad or good or whatever label we want to put on them. There's just stuff going on in life.
I'm going to spend some time thinking about how my first family and the way that I grew up has affected, you know, the way that I interact with people, because I don't know that I've really thought about it through that lens before, but I have been very aware of it now, of course, as my kids get older and as they start getting jobs and going to school, and I'm sort of just thinking about, oh my God, what decisions have I made and what was their first family like and how is that going to affect how they interact with people? It's easier to see it as I step back and watch it play out in their lives than it is for me to kind of go back and look at my own. But that's probably a really useful thing to do, because I can think of kind of I don't love confrontation and I was bullied a bit, and I can, it's a very straight line between those things that I saw in my early life. And oh yeah, I can see where that came from. I'm just not sure that I've thought about it like that before.
Mm. And how did that affect you? Does it mean that you avoided confrontation and worked really hard to avoid confrontation?
Yeah,
or
right.
Did you just leave? Did you go, right, I've just got to change jobs to avoid confrontation because, you know, I'm out, you know, which wasn't the right thing to do. You know, how does that play out, you know, in your relationships, you know, when things got tough? Are you a person that has to just get out of the room, you know, yeah, or are you a person that's trying to make everyone feel good? You know, maybe it's not even confrontation with you. Maybe there's a problem with the team and you're always the one trying to smooth, you know, the team's emotions. And that puts a lot of pressure on you if you're a team player as well. And the thing you just said about your kids, you know, we all have a voice in our head, you know, what we call it, the inner critic. And someone once said to me, he said, I think that voice is my parents' voice. We do. I mean, and look, to be careful about whatever you say to your children from now on in would be crazy, you know, and sometimes they do need to be told, oh, you know, if someone does something stupid, we have to tell them, you know, blah, 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 blah. But at the same token, it does give you a responsibility to go, okay, maybe how I look after my children, how I help them deal with difficult issues, how I help them deal with failure, how I help them deal with all those things, my voice will go with them in the future, you know, when they're adults. And I think that's quite an interesting, you know, makes you think about the world in a slightly different way.
Man, I'm gonna soak on that. I really like that. One of the things you've talked about too, Mark, that I don't see enough people talking about is this myth of the hero journey. And I don't know if it's, we've talked on this podcast before about kind of toxic positivity, and I don't know if it's the same thing, but how do you think of this? What do you think this myth is, and how do people need to start maybe thinking about the content they consume or the content they put out there, or just how they think about that hero journey?
That's just a really big question. So, you know, I'm a public speaker. I tell a story about becoming a stand-up comic, you know, as well as other things. I'm now trained as a psychologist, so I don't just tell that story. But that story was propagating a myth of how I was at this thing and I did this thing, and you know, and if you work hard enough, you can do that too. You know, that's effectively what I was doing and what you see speakers do all the time. And what we're forgetting is their personality traits may be completely different to yours. Their life experiences may be completely different to yours. Of course, memory is fallible. It's reconstructive. We don't remember everything as a perfect photo. It is a photocopy that fades and changes the more times it's brought out. And the version of the story you must have family stories where your version of the story is completely different to your mom or your dad's version of the story. You're both in the same room, the same thing happened, but it's completely different. And you both swear blind your version of events is true, and the truth of the matter is neither of your events is correct. We tell ourselves stories that become truth, whether they're the sad childhood stories that I like to tell, you know, my wife, when I want some sympathy, I'll tell her my sad childhood stories. Or when I'm, you know, on stage and I want people to laugh and I'm telling them a funny story about me becoming a stand-up and the myth of the hero and, you know, the hero's journey. So stories are there to help us. They help us make sense of the world. They're simplified versions of the world. They help us hide pain, all that stuff. That's why we do them as human beings. So that's the first thing. And there's something very attractive, isn't there, about a person telling a story where they've overcome a struggle. I mean, you're Canadian, but I suppose even in Canada, but, you know, I'm thinking more of America. You know, the foundational stories of America are about people going across the ocean, you know, having to leave their, you know, whether through they were criminals or whether they were religious zealots or whatever else they were, and going to America and taming it and, you know, the wilderness. And so there's a very much a foundational story about overcoming and taming this land and achieving things. So it's culturally, that's a huge thing. You know, the Second World War, you know, in Britain's psyche, it's just massive about how they see the world 80 years on. It's just every politician uses it. We hit that nostalgia button or hit a view of the world that's very rosy, that's completely not necessarily even true, you know, but we create a myth and we all respond to it. So that's a very powerful thing, and humans respond to that. So people do that. Now take on social media, where everything's about likes. I mean, I can't remember when it was that Facebook introduced the like button. But, you know, I'd love to do a study where you look at that and then you look at mental health of young people. It's because my guess is, I'm guessing that, but I didn't do it much good, because suddenly everything becomes about being liked or not being liked. And so that's great for the social media companies because it promotes engagement because we're all trying to get likes. So we all start to talk about stuff that gets us likes. By the variation of that, no one wants to say, well, you know, life's hard and it's a bit difficult. And, you know, if your personality is not the quite right personality and you didn't, you had a hard upbringing, maybe you can grow from trauma. But actually, if you're not, if you don't have access to money or education or the right people or a bit of luck, you won't achieve everything you want in life. There's some barriers to entry that you might have that another person who tells this story of how they did this thing, but actually they had no barriers of entry into those worlds or met people or were lucky enough to meet people. And the reason they were lucky enough to meet people because they were extrovert and they were born extrovert while you were born introvert. So that might be trickier for you. Quite complex all of a sudden, isn't it? It's suddenly, that's a hard sell on LinkedIn. everyone wants you to say, well, if you just work hard enough, you can have 1 million followers in a year. You know, that's the story we want to sell, isn't it? And if you work hard enough, you will achieve everything you want in life. And look, I believe in what we call locus of control in psychology, that, you know, an internal locus of control versus an external. Internal is my hard work, my effort. I will take responsibility for things whether they go wrong or bad. Well, an external locus of control, well, it's not me, it's society, it's racism, it's the government, it's whatever it might be. There's an external or external reasons for why I'm not achieving what I want in life. And actually, there's a useful thing, isn't it? Because if you have an external locus of control, that might protect your ego and how you feel about the world and protect your mental health, you know, in some respects, because it's not you, it's them. But also, if you have a very strong internal locus of control, that's great if things are going right. But what happens when you fail? Does that affect who you are, how you see the world? You know, and if you're high in neuroticism, again, back to your personality type, you know, if you're low in neuroticism and you fail, you go, oh, yeah, we fail fast and move forward. And off we go, you know, and the, you know, back to the tech leaders, ta-da. But, you know, if you're not one of those people and you're high in neuroticism and you fail, you go, failing's the worst thing in the world. You know, I got 98% in an exam as a child and my mother beat me. You know, that suddenly, you know, just depending on all those things we've talked about, suddenly affect how you are. And I just think that myth of the hero is a very powerful foundational thing that we all respond to, but it's just not very nuanced. And the one thing about social media, for all its goods and ills, nuance is not one of its greatest assets. And no one wants to hear a nuanced story. What they want to hear is a story about someone overcoming and achieving, and that you can do it too, without taking into any account of all the other things, money, privilege, wealth, access, luck, timing, all the other stuff that goes on that you had no control over, but it helped you along the way.
Yeah, I do think about that. I must admit, it's something that I think a bit, I think a lot more about it now. If I'm honest, I guess I worked hard, but things came pretty easy to me. And I can't ignore now in retrospect the fact that I'm a white dude, like I'm tall, like full head of hair. I mean, I don't know.
You're a good looking man.
I check all those boxes that make things a hell of a lot easier for me. And so when I describe that experience to other people and I sort of allow myself to admit that, yeah, this is probably very different than somebody of color or maybe a woman, or they'd be like, wait, you just did a good job and you got promoted like every time? Like that doesn't happened.
Well done you.
Right. Yeah. It's like, what are you talking about? This doesn't happen for everyone. And I work with a lot of founders, you know, starting businesses and leaders, and it's really hard. And it's just all of these hero stories about resilience and picking yourself up by the bootstraps and never giving up. It can make them feel really lonely and isolating because they're like, this isn't my experience at all. And I know maybe it's supposed to be uplifting, but most of the time it is the opposite.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think that's the, its idea is to be uplifting. I mean, you've summed that up beautifully. And it can be, but most of the time it just makes you feel, you can make it your self-worth very, very low. And also it can mean reaching out to other people to talk about those issues, quite difficult to do. So you end up this weird circle of always having to project this air of success, which is difficult, or you do the opposite thing where you have a complete breakdown and have a meltdown on LinkedIn, and then people feel schadenfreude and go, oh, you poor person, but ultimately are at home going, yes, I'm glad that's happened.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, this is, I mean, God, there's so many things that, Mark, that we've talked about that I'm going to be soaking on and reflecting on, which is always the mark of a great conversation and the kind of thing that I aim to have here. So thank you so much for that. I'm curious, what are you most excited about now? What's next for you?
So I think there's a few things. So I went back to university during COVID, got a master's in coaching psychology, which has really influenced how I, you know, helped me make sense of the world and me in the last 4 years. I'm doing another MSc at the moment in psychology with business. So I think really what I'm excited about is, A, finishing that course, because, you know, it's been 5 years of study, if I'm honest. There's been a lot of reading and writing. So I'm excited to finish them next September. But I think what I'm excited about is that it's given me a real better understanding of who I am, and to help me be kinder to other people who are different to me, which I think has played out not only in my coaching, you know, when I'm working with one-on-one with leaders and individuals and teams, but also in terms of how I approach LinkedIn and social media and how I'm more interested in trying to have a conversation with people. And don't get me wrong, it's transactional in some ways, but actually, I don't need a million followers. What I'm more interested in is having some people, connections that they write something and I think, oh, that's interesting. I'll give that some of my time and thought. I'll soak in it, back to your point, and maybe we'll have an interesting conversation. So I'm excited to see how that plays out on LinkedIn, my little corner of LinkedIn, in the next few years. And I'm excited about taking all that stuff and working with individuals and things. And I'm, you know, writing some new speeches at the moment, which is exciting. You know, I've got a hankering to go back to Edinburgh and do a 17th or 18th anniversary show. I'm not sure if my wife could cope with it. So at the moment, she's pushing back against that, but I've got a hankering to go back. So that might happen in the next couple of years as well. So yeah, there's lots to be excited about. The world's changing. Just so many interesting things going on at the moment. So I'm excited to see how that, all that stuff plays out in the world. I hope AI means all the boring jobs get done quicker, and therefore we can spend more time as people connecting with each other, you know, and caring about each other, and not having to write long memo. You know, actually, when you're a manager, actually spending time helping an employee rather than writing reports or doing spreadsheets and all that other stuff. So I'm hoping, for me, AI is a great hope for humans to properly connect and learn. So I'm in a hopeful place at the moment.
Yeah, I like that. I am too. I like that that vision for AI. And I think, you know, when I will reflect on this conversation, a couple of things that I'm really excited to think more about is this idea of understanding sort of my first team and how that shapes how I interact with people. And also, you know, you've given me some great insights on how to better understand and work with people that think and behave differently than me, because it's easy to get along with people who think and behave the way we do, but that's not most of the people. And if I look back and reflect on sort of my career and my life, yeah, that's definitely something I think that I haven't always been great at, and I still need to do a lot better at. So this has been, God, Mark, this has been amazing. We definitely went down a few rabbit holes that I wasn't expecting, which again is what organic kind of conversations are all about. So I'm very grateful for this time today.
Oh, so am I. Thank you. And I've had a great time. And as I say, you know, this conversation wouldn't have happened if it hadn't have been for social media and all those things. So it's, you know, there are good things that go on with it. So, you know, I was really grateful today, and I've really enjoyed it as well.
All right. That's amazing. We're going to include some links in the show notes for people that like what they heard today and want to connect with you on LinkedIn, hit up your website, learn more about where they can go to hear you speak. So, been amazing, Mark. Thanks again. So good.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.